David McCallum is one of Britain's most successful exports. He's currently known to millions of viewers as Dr. Donald Mallard, Ducky, the British medical examiner on the TV crime drama NCIS, now in its 13th series, but came to fame as Ilya Kuryakin in the 60s spy series The Man from U.N.C.L.E. with his co-star Robert Vaughan. Now 82, he's just published his first novel. Inspiration came after he was recording an audiobook of a crime thriller and thought he could write this stuff. Once a Crooked Man follows Harry, a New York actor who accidentally overhears gangsters plotting a murder and decides to head to London to warn their target.
Amidst the garbage, Harry stared at the little screen on his cell phone. Soon after he had begun listening under the window, he had quietly retrieved it from his pocket, turned on the notepad app, and tapped out names and phrases as he had heard them. A good 5 minutes passed before he ventured back to the sidewalk. To regain his composure, he began to walk. After a few blocks, he came across a coffee shop. In a booth by the window, he ordered a bagel with a side order of bacon and a cup of coffee. Switching on his cell phone, he read through the list. One thing was clear. Someone in London was about to be terminated, someone with the name Villiers, presumably by an assassin named Rocky.
An extract from Once a Crooked Man. When I spoke to David McCallum on the line from New York, we discussed both the book and an impressively eclectic career that began in the 1950s when he was an angry young man in such social realism screen dramas as Violent Playground and before making the move to Hollywood and superstardom. As well as recording a number of instrumental albums, notably the much-sampled track The Edge, McCallum's been a cult presence on British TV with the fantasy series Sapphire and Steel. And as he reveals, he has a very strong work ethic and some controversial views on politics and storytelling. But we began with why he'd wanted to write a novel at all.
I started with the premise of an actor being handed a suitcase with $1 million in it. Clearly, I was out of work at the time, and it was some sort of fantasy in my own mind. And then I wrote a story about him, and then I got into money laundering, and then I got into the Drug Enforcement Agency here in New York. So all of a sudden, my life became a little complicated as I started to research the idea of what happened to this actor. And it went in and out of drawers until about 5 years ago. All the time an exercise when I was out of work with something to do in order, you know, I just wanted to learn how to put the words on the page.
It's really interesting you say it was an exercise because it's very slickly done and you clearly have always had this attitude of going off and doing your own research. And I gather you put yourself on some autopsy study beyond what you needed for your kind of medical examiner character in NCIS.
Right. Oh, yes. I've worked with the coroner. I've done full autopsy, not touching anything, just standing there right next to him. On those occasions when I've been witnessing autopsy, that has been quite miraculous. The human body is an extraordinary machine.
I want to take a moment to ask about your character Ducky on NCIS, this ex-army British medical examiner.
Gibbs is right. Whoever he is, he's not going to get you.
There's only one thing better than looking into the eyes of a beautiful woman and have her say that everything's going to be all right.
And what's that, Ducky?
My saying it to her.
Gibbs, what did Ducky look like when he was younger?
Ilya Kuryakin.
You're such a huge star now to a whole new generation of fans. Is it 13 seasons you've done so far? Oh.
Yes, we're in our 13th and we'll soon be negotiating a 14th.
Why is he so loved and why do you love doing it?
I love doing it because of the people I'm with. I'm well paid, which you cannot neglect on these occasions. I have 8 grandchildren and they all need an education fund to put them through college and things. And at the same time, I get to learn all about pathology and occasionally go down and work with a coroner. I mean, the whole thing could not be better.
Now, I want to ask a slightly serious question about the book, because it's got this lovely jokey action tone and it seems in a way to draw very much on those 60s by capers from The Man from U.N.C.L.E. You know, there was lots of fun and there's lots of sex. But there is this one character, and I've seen a lot of readers on reader forums say that female police officer at one point gets raped and then is said to have enjoyed it. And I think the line is, for the first time in her life, a man had forced her into submission and dominated her as no other had ever done. And she found the whole experience exhilarating. And it all ends well for her. But can you see why some readers have been a bit shocked. I was a bit surprised myself.
Well, I was a bit surprised as well. When you have somebody, as you're writing that character, the character of Lizzie, and she is one of those people who's had to all her life take care of herself right from the very beginning, when she's teaching herself to go downstairs backwards in order not to fall down, and keeping scraps of food in case her mother didn't come up with dinner, had absolutely had to be self-sufficient and then became very dominant. I've met girls, women like that, and they like to dominate their men. And it's as a result of their upbringing. And all of a sudden in her life, she's dominated by someone else in almost a violent way. And it's that realization that she doesn't have to take care of herself fully. Now she can share the responsibility of growing up. Her development, in other words, takes on a whole new tack. And I think it's as a result of that sexual encounter with Max.
Wow, so you're very much defending it. I just wanted to ask, because as I say, the book is great fun, but that it felt, as it's a work of imagination, that I don't think I've ever come across a woman who would say that.
Well, you have now, and her name is Lizzie.
Okay. Can I ask a bit about the start of your career here? Because you studied at RADA, you started in British film and TV, and I find you an intriguing presence in a lot of 50s British films. Notably, you're this kid brother in Hell Drivers, and then you're this very sensitive young man, kind of, who's at risk of being a hoodlum in Violent Playground.
Do you know what I want to know, Johnny?
What?
Why, you hang around with those layabouts.
What else is there to do?
Get a job.
There aren't any jobs.
You're frightened of getting your hands dirty, is that what it is?
What if it is?
Look, my business is to look after the twins. If they've got a brother who...
Ah, quit preaching. You're coming up. Sergeant, Johnny's inviting you.
Can I take you back to that time and what your vision was of your career then?
In those days, you were conscious of wanting to succeed financially. That was number one. I remember coming back from the army. I was in West Africa in the Royal West African Frontier Force as a young second lieutenant. And coming back and really feeling totally lost and not knowing what to do and talking to my mother about it, who was very helpful. And then just going out and meeting with people in repertory and various places, getting myself an agent, which was very important, and just struggling away. And through that, I did movies like Freud with Montgomery Clift. I did the early movies with Rank. You know, it's a sort of progression that tumbles, one event leading to another to another. You really have no control over it.
You'll know, of course, the 60s spy series Man from U.N.C.L.E. was and is still one of the most loved things you've done. I'm fascinated that for a character, you know, Ilya Kuryakin, he was very cerebral, he was very aloof, he was very indifferent, he didn't show his feelings. And, of course, he was a Russian communist at the start of the series, at the height of the Cold War. Is it true that you got more fan mail than any other star ever at MGM, including Elvis?
If they said I did, then I did. But I have, you know, it didn't come through the door. You know, it was sackfuls of mail. And we did go up to the mail room, Robert Vaughan and I, and have our picture taken with it, obviously.
I am Ilya Kuryakin. I am also an enforcement agent. Like my friend Napoleon, I go and I do whatever I am told to by our chief.
I didn't think about it at all. I mean, you got up in the morning at 4 or 5 in the morning, you went to work, got in your trailer, had something to eat, worked all day and went home very tired and fell asleep and did that 5 days a week. And it worked. The ratings went up. We went from black and white to colour.
You lost your accent when it went from black and white to colour. You suddenly became less Russian, didn't you?
Well, that was conscious because I thought if this guy's going to live in the country and be an agent with this worldwide organisation, his American accent should really just, you know, instead of dropping all the articles, he'd start using them.
How do you feel about being a heartthrob at the time? I mean, you know, there were hordes of girls used to follow you around. Was it something you know, perhaps you didn't like? I know some actors find it very difficult.
Well, it's not a matter of liking or disliking. In those cases, it was a matter of survival. I was terrified any time that we were in a situation where I was not protected, and there were a lot of young women and men, too, you know. I did some albums for Capitol, and I was supposed to go to Macy's one day and sign albums. And the police were there. They said, you can't go down there. It was much too dangerous. We would not be responsible for what happened to you. And I didn't go down, and they tore up the whole floor. They did $25,000 worth of damage to Macy's. And in Central Park, I was taking a walk in Central Park, and it took two mounted policemen to lift me up bodily out of a crowd of people and ride me out of the park. I mean, that's scary stuff.
Sapphire and steel have been assigned.
I want to take you on a bit, because you are still this very interesting presence in British TV culture, and there was obviously Colditz in the 70s, but this fascinating afterlife for Sapphire and Steel, which has influenced a lot of recent Doctor Whos, and the novelist David Mitchell, his latest novel, Slade House, and he's one of our most acclaimed writers, he told me was directly influenced by Sapphire and Steel. Could you say what your characters were for people who are too young to remember?
The fabric of time is something that you don't mess around with. And at any time, anybody or anything from the other side, either in the future or in the past, comes through that fabric of time. They have to have agents sent out to plug the hole, send the people back and put things back in order.
Not the two of you.
So the two of them. I wore a bluish suit, so I was Steel. And Joanna, as Sapphire, had a sapphire blue dress. And the fascinating thing about it to me is we shot it with four huge lumbering television cameras. It was in the days of live television when the cameras were like small Volkswagens. So the thing was edited as we shot it. Back then, the tape was about 3 inches wide and on huge reels. And there was no real way of editing it because you couldn't look at it. And I believe there was a technician somewhere in the studio who realized if you scattered baby powder on the tape and shook it, the magnetic lines began to show and he was able to find where he could cut, which really is, to me, is a form of television history.
I gather that you've taken your children to Scotland to kind of see your family's roots. Do you still feel an affinity with this small island?
You know, there's no doubt that I am very much Scots at heart. And so we had a wonderful time up all along the castles in the north of Scotland and going to everywhere where I grew up.
Why did you leave Britain?
You know, there was a thing of go west, young man. Also, it was the first time that Britain had really begun to be a socialist country. I was always brought up with the idea that you take care of yourself. All of a sudden, there was this entitlement that the government can hand you anything that you really need. And to me, that spelled doom. I'm sorry, that's the way I was brought up.
Was this, what, the 60s or the 70s? With Labour?
That would be the early 60s, late 50s. It was the first socialist government that came into the United Kingdom. And the idea of going west, young man, just seemed to be the right thing to do.
You recently said Donald Trump is telling it like it is. Is there something you think we don't understand in Britain where Trump is widely regarded as a dangerous joke?
I think there's an awful lot of people in this country don't understand why it's happening. It's trust in government, I think. We can't trust the government, and that's happened here. And I think Trump came along and he said a lot of very outrageous statements. But in a funny way, he touched a nerve that it's time for change. It's time to rein in the spending, to rein in the irresponsibilities that arise, the waste. So it's the frustration, I think, that he is tapping into.
David McCallum, his novel Once a Crooked Man is out now.